Okay, now we're going to call the Ways and Means Committee to order. Members, in your package, you have the minutes from February 20th. Representative Dean is moving the minutes for February 20th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes for February 20th are adopted. Representative Garofalo, you have House File 600. Representative Garofalo moves House File 600 to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, there is one amendment that I'd like to move. That is the A-21 amendment.
Representative Garofalo moves the A-21 amendment to your amendment.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, there was some concern in the previous committees whether the House File 600 bill would apply to those prevailing wage contracts that local units of government have with their own contracts. What this section does is it makes it very clear that it does not apply to prevailing wage with regards to those contracts. So it addresses those concerns that were in the committee.
Okay. Members, any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-21 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Garofalo, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is the Uniform Labor Standards Bill. There are two sections in the bill that have fiscal appropriations. Section 3 includes the $750,000 that would be necessary in the upcoming biennium to fund the Public Employment Relations Board. Section 4 is the appropriation that contains part of the governor's recommendation for additional wage theft enforcement, again, totaling $750,000 over fiscal year 18 and fiscal year 19. Those complete the fiscal provisions of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Members, questions to the bill as amended? Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, is there going to be an opportunity? I see we have a lot of people in the audience for them to comment at all about the bill.
Representative Carlson, some chairs have testimony provided. Representative Knobloch, I know, does it that way, but the Ways and Means has had some people testify and some people not. I know when you were chair, you did not have testimony. I think for today's purposes, everybody's familiar with this bill, and so I don't intend to take any testimony, but if you have any questions to the bill.
Madam Chair, that's not accurate. When I was chair of Ways and Means, the approach we used at the time, and I was very consistent in that regard, was that anyone who had not had an opportunity to testify before a previous committee was able to testify. So that was the position that I had throughout. And in fact, we interpreted it pretty liberally. If somebody even had testified the previous committee, we were pretty open to allowing that. But I don't know. Nobody's contacted me that they want to testify. I just saw that we have quite a good turnout here, and I didn't know if somebody wanted to comment or not. But what are you ruling it?
Well, staff tells me that no one has contacted the committee asking to provide testimony. If there is, this has traveled through how many committees? Two committees for that reason. We have the two provisions on here, the direct appropriations, that way you don't have a fiscal note in your packets. But let me think about it, Representative Carlson. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I haven't been on any of those other committees, so I'm discussing this for the first time, but there are three letters in our packet that that I think have some helpful points. The League of Minnesota Cities argues about local control. Preservation of local control in Minnesota has yielded statewide benefits. Cities are often laboratories for determining public policy approaches to the challenges that face residents and businesses. And then on behalf of my city of St. Paul, they too make the point of local control is a critical element of our democracy. And then they point out that they would welcome the opportunity to work with the state if we wanted to look at state impacts of this, and perhaps we could replicate some of the work done in our city. And here's the point they make: ensuring that no one has to choose between going to work sick and paying rent, or between going to work sick and losing a job. It should be a nonpartisan issue for the state of Minnesota. This is particularly true in a time when the conversations at the federal level leave Minnesotans with significant uncertainty of the future of their health care. So both the League of Minnesota Cities and my own city, I think, are making some powerful arguments about the wisdom of local control.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask Representative Garofalo what these two appropriations have to do with the underlying bill. Why are these in here? And by the way, this is the first time I've heard the bill also. I haven't heard any testimony on it. And I'm not that familiar with it, Madam Chair, but I'd like to know from Representative Garofalo why he's got these two appropriations in here.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, as everyone knows, in order for anything to become a bill, this law requires bipartisan support. It's going to require the support of both Republicans and DFLers. In designing this bill and introducing it in the Jobs Committee, the committee thought it was wise to try to send a good faith effort to the administration and to DFLers that we are willing to compromise. Certainly not a final offer, but we do know that the Public Employee Relations Board is a very provocative and controversial issue that I opposed when I was when it came up for a vote on the House floor the last 2 years. I was the one who delayed its implementation for 2 years. And so the intent of including that in there is to set the framework for a positive set of negotiations going forward. In the event that we're not able to reach bipartisan agreement, those provisions and the House File 600 will not become law. In the event that we are successful, then, again, it's going to be because we address each other's concerns. So that was put in there to send a message to those who are left concerns or opponents to the bill that this is something that we recognize is going to require consensus and bipartisan agreement.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Garofalo, at least you're honest. I think, there was a little discussion on the floor with Representative Knobloch and Representative Pepin about putting policy into finance bills. That's something that the public often complains about, that we hide provisions with other provisions when they don't really go there. And here you're doing the opposite, putting finance provisions into a policy bill. Essentially, if I could kind of paraphrase what you said, I would characterize it as twisting arms. So it makes it harder to vote against because we're voting against something that we like in addition to something that we very much don't like. And I'm not going to be coerced into voting for this bill for that reason, and I don't know how many of us will. Policy, these finance provisions belong in finance bills, not here. And I just want to say that even though I haven't had a chance to hear this bill before, as I understand the bill, this is really about an attempt to take sick pay away from some employees that have never had it before, that now will be able to have sick pay. And I just, in family leave, and I just think this is really distressing that as some employees have been given some new benefits, and we're talking, I think, about employees who are probably at the lower end, because these days we hear a lot about how hard it is to get employees, and the employers who are not giving their employees already some sick leave and some family leave, I would say are probably not very good employers. But here we're letting some employees, Minneapolis and St. Paul, have gone through the process of looking closely at this and have decided that people in those cities deserve to have some additional employee benefits, give them a little bit of leverage against employers. And what this bill does is essentially is take that away. And so I don't think we should talk about it in terms of preemption, and you know, that all gets kind of into the weeds and becomes very confusing. When should things be preempted? When should they not? I think the clear thrust of this bill, if not the intent, is to take sick leave and family leave away from those employees in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and whatever other lipstick you might put on the bill, I think it's still a pig.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, my intent in putting sections 3 and 4 in the bill was to gain bipartisan support and to gain consensus. Clearly that was a mistake. I misinterpreted what members will do. So, Madam Chair, I'll move the A-22 amendment to delete those sections from the bill. Then.
Representative Garofalo moves the A-22 amendment. Members, to the amendment.
And so, Madam Chair, what this will do is this will delete the appropriations I referenced in my introduction.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I would argue against removing those two provisions from the bill. One of the issues is the prayer board, which I happen to be the author of a few years back, and the reason that we created the board was that when you're resolving, and that's, by the way, just public employee contracts we're talking about here, and one of the issues is that without the prayer board, you go into the courts, which is a much more costly way to resolve the issues. And the other part of the amendment deals with wage and hourly enforcement, if I recall. And so I would encourage the keeping of that language in the bill, and I would request a roll call vote.
Representative Carlson has requested a roll call vote. Any other members to the amendment on the A23?
Madam Chair.
Representative Grappo.
Again, the purpose of having these sections in the bill is to make it easier to reach bipartisan consensus when this bill is in conference committee. And I'm hearing two different voices in the DFL. One says that the committee was wise in including this language in the bill, and I hear another voice that says that they were not wise. And I'm wondering if someone on the DFL side could give me some clarity about whether you want this language in the bill or not.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, at least speaking as one member on this side of the aisle, I would like to see the language remaining in the bill.
Representative Lubley.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, frankly, I don't know that much about these particular issues as Representative Carlson does, but I don't think it does belong in here, so I would vote to take it out. You know, we're not herd of followers. We're individual members, and so, you know, I can't help you get the consensus here, but that certainly is my feeling about it.
Again, Madam Chair, the entire purpose of the committee, the entire reason why the committee put this language in the bill was to try to make it easier for us to communicate and compromise on what is a very important issue. I would point out, members, that the introduction of the PERB language is, in fact, a mandate on local units of government. So as much as we're hearing about local control, the PERB inclusion would actually require local units of government to use that process. So, Madam Chair, members, I want to make the bill less controversial. I want to make it easier to get in the conference committee. So I would renew my motion to have the H-22 amendment.
Okay. Any other members to the amendment? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll. Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Aye.
Representative Cornish?
Aye.
Representative Davids?
Aye.
Representative Dean?
Yes.
Representative Detmer? Representative Drazkowski? Representative Fabian?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Gunther?
Yes.
Representative Hamilton? Representative Hausman?
No.
Representative Hillstrom? Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Loon? Representative Marcourt?
No.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Morinus?
Yes. Yes.
Representative Pawlowski? Representative Poppy?
No.
Representative Torkelson?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl? Representative Wagenius?
No.
Thank you. On a vote of 13-7, the amendment is adopted. Representative Garofalo, I have a couple other members that have questions to your bill. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. Representative Garofalo, I agree with the provisions in House File 600. I mean, I do think that a hodgepodge of laws creates an undue, unfair kind of administrative compliance burden for businesses. I do. And another reason that hasn't been brought up is I do think it creates an unlevel playing field, especially for rural Minnesota, when you have a hodgepodge of laws. I mean, already the median income in rural Minnesota is about 32% lower than in the metro area. And while a lot of cities down here could politically, for whatever reason, raise the minimum wage, the reality is out in rural Minnesota, out in my area, that's just competitively and realistically that can't be done. So I support the bill in that fashion. What I'm thinking about is, and I know you and I have talked a little bit about this, is how do you, you know, how do you get this into law? And the truth of the matter is, this isn't going to get there. I mean, just this, because you've got two sides. And, you know, it's kind of a win-lose at this point, and win-loses aren't going to get us there when we have a divided government. And yet, on the other side of the coin, you know, it's not right that if you've got a single mother with two children working full-time at the minimum wage, they're still in poverty. Or, you know, a person shouldn't have to decide between caring for their sick parent or the sick child and kind of their financial security. So you've got that side of things too. So what I'd like to see, what happens is, and you know, we've got at least 2 years of divided government, and then we've got a gubernatorial election coming up in 2018, and I don't know if anyone can necessarily predict how that's going to occur. But, I mean, there's a good chance that for another 6 years, we're going to have divided government, which means the win-loses propositions become lose-lose because neither side will get what they want, just the things that I outlined there. And so, you know, we could go another 6 years where you now have Minneapolis-St. Paul, now you might have Duluth, you might have Rochester, now you've got other cities, which I think, you know, hurts the disparity out in rural Minnesota because you've got higher wages here, folks from rural Minnesota, because we can't raise the wage, it's going to head out, you've got more rural flight to the cities. And yet, if nothing occurs, you still got a minimum wage that's going up by about a dime a year, and you still don't have, you know, folks that have to still decide between sick leave. So my point is, I just think before we move on, both sides of the table should really come together and see if they can forge something that would be, instead of a lose-lose, a win-win. That's what I would like to see. Otherwise, we're going to go probably at least 2, if not 6 years at the minimum, where we're just going to have this battle. And, you know, I'm one of maybe a few members here that I'm a union member, Education Minnesota, and I'm also belong to my local chamber. And when I was the mayor in Dilworth, business, we wanted business in town. You know, supporter there. And so I want to see both sides benefit from something. I know you do too, because we've talked about that. And it's to get there. And, you know, how do we kind of break loose from labor versus business? And I'd like to see something come between. So I guess the question after all of this, Madam Chair, is, I mean, do you kind of see things that way also, that for this to really work, both sides have to see a win?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, I agree with your comments 100%. I mean, there's just sending a bill to the governor that he's going to veto doesn't accomplish anyone's goals. This is a problem that, without elaborating more on the policy, I see a lot of local fights breaking out at the city and county level, maybe not necessarily on progressive issues, but actually from other groups that are going to use the initiative and referendum process to, for example, push paycheck protection, to prohibit have a municipal ordinance that would prohibit employers from taking union dues out of people's paychecks and requiring a check for it. There are right-to-work initiatives getting sponsored now at the municipal level. So I view it taking a step back from the policy that this is a mechanism to see a lot more fighting going on, And especially with what's happening in Washington right now, I think it's important that the state of Minnesota differentiate itself and its local units of government differentiate itself from what's going on in Washington, and to try to reach consensus and just have more level-headed government. And so beyond that, I do think I'm committed to working with the governor and working with the DFS outside groups to address their concerns. I think it's important to recognize that there are 100 different ways we can solve this problem to address things. You know, I had an idea on the front side of this bill. Obviously, that wasn't a good idea. But if there are, I think there are multiple ways we can solve this problem, and I'm hopeful, and I'm actually cautiously optimistic. I mean, even the Star Tribune endorsed this bill in their paper this weekend. So I'm hopeful that as we go forward, we can reach that agreement and consensus, because having the bill not become law or veto benefits no one representing Marquardt. So thanks for the comment.
Yeah.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ruffalo. And I do think you're moving in that direction with what we had in there with the wage theft portion and the PERB and so forth. But that... It's still not quite there. This is a pretty big deal for the preemption, and I think it's you have to look at some sick leave stuff and maybe even some minimum wage proposals. But I just think as we move this along, it doesn't encourage folks getting together, and that's my only concern about moving this along, is that we still haven't brought the parties together to make this a win-win, because I've got, like I said, I support the provisions in House File 600, but I just, it's not going to become law without the other side, which I also support. So I encourage you to continue your efforts to bring folks together. And I guess I would really encourage both sides to start earnestly getting together to come to some compromise on this that could be a win-win for all, for our labor and for our businesses in this state.
Well put, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Graffalo, you talked to us about communicating and compromising, and you said you wanted positive negotiations going forward. So the question I have about who's negotiating here?
Representative Graffalo.
Did you... before you drafted this bill, did you sit down with my city council members? I am in Minneapolis, or part in Minneapolis anyway, and talk to them about the process that they went through to arrive at the sick leave that they came up with? Did you talk to my mayor about this? Is that part? Are they part of the positive negotiations going forward?
Representative Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, two things. Number one, Representative Wagenius, as you know, the Minneapolis ordinance is currently in litigation, so local officials are limited in what they can share in their public and private comments. Second of all, as I would tell you, that those are some conversations I have had privately with stakeholders and elected officials in Minneapolis, and I think it's fair to say that there is a diversity of opinion of what elected officials in Minneapolis want the legislature to do, and I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, you can talk to folks who perhaps opposed it, but this was the position. We do have representative government and majority rules, and this is what Minneapolis came up with after a long and arduous process. And so there is much public information that can be talked about, and about the process that went through and how folks came to the decision they did. So I would again ask, did you talk to folks who worked hard on it, like my mayor, Betsy Hodges, or Councilmember Elizabeth Glidden?
Representative Graffalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, those are two individuals I have not spoken with about this matter.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, if we're going to have positive negotiations going forward, it does seem to me that the people who worked on this, and you can see Elizabeth Glidden's letter to us, where she said we had sought significant and diverse stakeholder input, and that is true. They spend a lot of time on it, and they found that 41% of Minneapolis workers don't have access to paid sick time, many of whom work in the service industry. So going to work sick is meeting with coworkers and customers, not a good deal. Chipotle will tell you that. So if we're going to have positive negotiations going forward, it does seem to me that we have to be negotiating with the people who actually worked on this issue, not with folks up here. It's not enough. People think this is a power grab, and if you're not talking to the people who worked on it, that's a good characterization.
Madam Chair and Representative Vigenius, just to be clear, you said that we are not, that I am not working with the people on this who made this decision, and I never said that. You asked about two specific individuals, and I responded, I have not had conversations with them. So let's be clear about those remarks.
I Representative Vigenius, I will respond by saying those were probably the most important players. So if you're working for some of the most important players, certainly the mayor is a mayor, and Councilman Bert Glidden was our lead. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to make this similar point about my city that Representative Vigenius made, and I think it is very important that we read into the record the comments of the city of Minneapolis, and Representative Vigenius referred to those, but in the last paragraph of the letter that was passed around, Councilmember Glidden notes that as locally elected officials representing the residents of the city of Minneapolis, we have a unique lens on the needs and concerns of our residents and are best able to respond to those needs. And so I want to reiterate, not only is this a bad policy, but you know, we really are taking a very extreme approach to usurping local control, and that's also mentioned in the Metro Cities letter where they talk about support of local control and decision-making authority. Metro Cities policies support local control and decision-making authority under the premise that locally elected officials are in the best position to respond to a community's specific needs. And so, you know, this is a pretty radical taking away of local control. And I think in this discussion of you know, how best to move forward, you know, if we want to get a bill signed and we want some broader consensus, let's just once and for all pass a statewide sick and safe policy that could be implemented at the state level, and then you wouldn't see these cities coming up with these alternative approaches and the need to exercise local control on these kinds of very, very important economic decisions for our residents. So I strongly oppose this, and again, I think it sets a terrible precedent for what we're going to do with, to local municipalities. You know, it could open the door to all kinds of things. You know, why would we even have local government if we're doing local government, if we're acting like a city council here at the state legislature? So I'd encourage members to vote no on this.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To go along with Representative Hornstein's comments that represent Garofalo, folks came to the legislature and they tried to raise the minimum wage higher. Folks came to the legislature and they tried to pass sick and safe time statewide. The state has failed to do that. Businesses have failed to provide that across the state, and community members have said, we need it. And so, Representative Garofalo, it isn't that these community members haven't come to folks like you and I to say, please make these policies statewide. The legislature has failed to step up to do it. So they have gone to the next best place, which are local communities, to say, please give us this benefit. And those folks have agreed to do that. They believe that these policies are so important to their residents that they should implement them. So, Representative Garofalo, I believe that this is the wrong direction. I believe that there should be a statewide policy doing the right thing, offering sick and safe time and having $15 minimum wage. And If the legislature continues to fail to do that, then I believe that the local community should retain the right to do that.
Representative Cornish.
Representative Garofalo, I just wanted to thank you. It's a great bill. I'm disappointed in the League of Minnesota Cities for furnishing this letter. I don't think it's a wise policy for the state just to force businesses to pay more. They're certainly not asking for that in my district. And I remember when we put the preemption isn't anything new. It's the same reason we used it in the handgun permit law, so there wouldn't be a patchwork of crazy regulations all over the state not knowing, you know, what you're going to run into from county to county. I think this is not local control, it's local chaos, and I thank you for your bill.
Members, at this time, in recognition of Representative Carlson's comments, if there is an individual, we take testimony by Representative Knobloch's pattern. He will take testimony from one individual who has not testified in any other committee before on this issue. And your comments, because this is a finance committee, need to be directed towards Section 3 and Section 4 of the bill. Is there anybody that wants to testify on Section 3 and Section 4 of the bill that was removed? All right, with that, members, I don't have anybody else set. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I assume you're moving toward a vote then, and I just wanted to comment, and I want to begin, though, with a question of Representative Garofalo. There have been comments in the last few minutes about moving in the direct. In the other direction, rather than what I'll call a punitive approach by taking salary and fringe benefits away from about 150,000 people, if you looked at all toward establishing statewide standards that would provide for a livable wage and for sick leave. That would be the other direction. And Madam Chair, I also read the Tribune article. And a good part of that Tribune article was devoted toward reaching a compromise. And one of the things that they advocated in that article was a higher statewide minimum wage. So I don't want to leave people with the impression that there was a flat-out endorsement of this bill, because they were really, most of that editorial, in my view, was devoted toward trying to suggest a compromise and moving in the direction of trying to improve, and a term that I will use, that people on both the sides of the aisle have talked about what we need to do to grow the middle class. And this bill does not do that. In fact, as I say, it goes in a punitive direction, taking benefits away from people that would need a livable wage. And, you know, as a consumer of various products, I would appreciate knowing going into a restaurant where the preparers of the food or the servers, if they're feeling ill, have had an opportunity to take a day off to use some sick time. And I think that's a public health issue that we should be paying close attention to as we look at this preemption bill. But bottom line, I've made my kind of concluding comments, other than I would like a response from the author. If you did look at going with improved statewide standards to help us grow the middle class.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, just as a historical reference point, I think it's important to point out that the minimum wage was increased. From 2014 to now, the minimum wage was increased from $7.25 to $9.50 an hour. So it hasn't been as if, though, no action has been taking place on the minimum wage. In fact, quite a sizable increase in the minimum wage over the last less than 2.5 years. With regards to the mandated sick leave and mandated benefits, 2 points. Number one, I think we're all in favor of seeing higher wages and higher benefits. The dispute is over whether government should be mandating those wages and benefits. With regards to a sick leave benefit, I'll repeat what I've said publicly, and that is if you're going to go forward with a statewide focus on a sick leave program, a three-pronged test I think should apply to it is the following. A, that if you like your current sick leave program that you have, you should be able to keep it. No one should be forced into adopting the statewide program. Second of all is that it should be voluntary. We should not be forcing employers and employees to go into a program they don't want to belong to. And third and finally, whatever's applying to the private sector should also apply to government. Now, again, that's a personal opinion, but I would think that's a three-pronged test I've applied to such a measure.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you know, the minimum wage increase did pass, and I would view that as a step in the right direction. But many of us at the time we were dealing with that also were talking about a livable wage, which is a different question than simply increasing the minimum wage, as important as that was at that point in time.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill, I think, that certainly needs some work, but I think that the idea about uniformity is one that needs to be considered. And, you know, we throw a lot of words out there, and local mandate, or local control, and mandates, and other things. We talk a lot about a lot of different things. One thing that we don't always talk about is compromise, and what truly does that mean to compromise, and what truly does that mean when you put forth your ideas, your considerations, and you listen to the other side, and you try to do what is the best for the most involved. And I think that this bill, although I do appreciate the uniformity issue, I think that there are, you know, it's challenging sometimes to be in the middle. It's challenging to be someone who is pro-labor and pro-business, because a lot of bills that come through are pro-labor or anti-labor. They're pro-business or anti-business in the minds or in the eyes of other people. So to try to come to that compromise, to that point in the middle or somewhere in the middle, is challenging. And Representative Garofalo, you're taking this on. I know you've got broad shoulders and you're capable of taking this on, but I do strongly encourage you to try to be that convener of both sides and try to bring people together, and know that there are some of us who would like to see that happen. I appreciate that Representative Marquardt talked about the win-win possibility, and I think that this is a win-win possibility, but it doesn't come unless those on either side say, this is going to be something we will accept, we will look at, we will consider, and we will compromise on. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Garofalo, for your openness, your expressed openness to working to find some path forward, if that's necessary, on this legislation. As I have been, now we're, 6 weeks into the session, people keep asking me how it's going, and I continue to reflect with people that I think that we are disconnected. We're pretty disconnected from Minnesotans in this legislature, and this is one of those examples. We're talking about finding bipartisan compromise on a piece of legislation that would tip the scale in favor of businesses, and businesses are owned and run by Minnesotans. But if there was any message they got out of the last election, loud and clearly, is that Minnesotans are really struggling in this economy, even though the economy is doing pretty well. They're struggling with health care costs and the costs of putting their kids through college and saving for their retirement, and frankly, they're angry about it, and we know that. And our response to that is saying we're going to put the finger on the scale of business, and not allow Minnesotans to push forward an idea that might improve their own economic circumstances. And that feels wrong to me, and it feels disconnected to me. And I think we're missing the boat one more time for the people of Minnesota. So I don't know what you do with that thought. It might not be all that helpful to you, Representative Garofalo, but if we're really wanting to reflect the mood and the spirit of the people right now, I think we need to pay attention to their economic circumstances, and I'm afraid that this legislation doesn't make that mark, not yet.
Representative Levin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to add one more thought, and that is that, you know, we can talk on different issues about whether it's a good idea to have things done at the local level or done at the state level for uniformity, and there are arguments on both sides of that which can go back and forth depending on the issue. But here we're in a unique situation where two large cities, the two largest cities in the state, have passed ordinances exercising their local authority, and this bill comes in to tell them, no, we're going to roll that back and take that authority away from you now that you've already exercised it. And I view that, as somebody else here said, that's just an exercise in power. And it reminds me of what has happened in Michigan, although obviously not as extreme, but the direction that we are going is the one that has happened in Michigan, where the legislature decided to usurp local control in a pretty extreme way by appointing a city manager for Flint, Michigan. And that city manager made a decision without the cooperation of the local elected officials, who basically have no authority, and we all know what happened as a result of that. Now, was that directly because the legislature exercised that authority and took it away from the locals? Well, it probably was in that case. And I see that that's not exactly what you're doing here, Representative Garofalo, but I think that it does kind of smack of that kind of use of power. We know that counties and cities are creatures of the state, and if the legislature and the governor decided to do so, they could be abolished altogether, and everything could be run out of St. Paul. And we see that that is not necessarily smart. For just to look what happened in Flint, that, you know, unbelievable harm could have been avoided had the legislature not tried to usurp local control in that instance. So I think this bill, because it comes after two city councils, two cities have made very considered decisions about what kinds of rights they want employees in their cities to have, that the legislature to come in now and say, no, you can't do it, I think that's a very inappropriate use of power.
Representative Garofalo, final thoughts.
Madam Chair, members, she pointed out that whether cities have this authority or power is currently under litigation. There has been a stay issued on some of the ordinance that's in Minneapolis. My preference would be that we make this decision as a legislature and conform with what has been the practice of our state for 100 years. But I recognize that there's open litigation on this matter. But again, most importantly, I want to thank those who have been working behind the scenes and offering positive yet constructive criticism, and look forward to us reaching a conclusion on this matter before the end of the legislative session. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Okay, and Representative Garofalo renews his motion that House File 600 be referred to the General Register. As amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. The bill passes. Thank you, members.
That was a good one. Thank you. I was going to make one more. And so, Representative Cornish, maybe people in...
I never thought that would happen to.
I couldn't see something.
Good morning. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Sean Welch. I'm the Director of the Reports and Forecast Division of the Department of Human Services.
Mr. Chair, I'm Susan Snyder, the Assistant Director of Reports and Forecast, Department of Human Services.
Thank you. And I'll turn it over to you for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We're just going to provide a brief overview of medical assistance, or MA, spending, as well as Minnesota Care spending. We have a PowerPoint here that we'll walk through. Looks like everything's working all right. To start, the projections that we're going to see in future slides are from the November budget forecast. This first slide here, we're going to start with looking briefly at what actually happened in state fiscal year 16. And this first slide goes over the entire set of forecasts and programs that we do in the Department of Human Services. And as you can see, there are four large pieces of the pie, and those four comprise medical assistance, or MA. The dark blue piece of the pie is long-term care facilities and home and community-based waiver services, and that comprises 34% of all of the programs that we forecast in terms of dollars. We're talking in terms of total dollars here, state, federal, local, all dollars. The green slice of the pie is basic care for elderly and disabled individuals, and that comprises about 18% of our total forecasted programs. The light blue pie is basic care for adults without children. That's about 13%. And the red slide is basic care for families with kids, and that's about 24%. So all told, of all of the dollars that we project in DHS, MA is about 89% of those dollars. The other, let's stay within MA. Within MA, about 58% of the MA forecast is for elderly and disabled. And that is the dark blue and the green slide. That includes long-term care facilities and waivers, as well as basic care. MA adults without children, we said, is 13% of the all funds forecast. If this was a general fund picture, that piece of the pie would all but disappear, because in fiscal year 16, the adults without kids were 100% federally funded. In MA, the families with children is the largest group in terms of enrollees, but it is the lowest in per capita cost. Outside of MA, Minnesota Care, you see, is a piece of the pie that's about 4% of forecasted programs, and the rest of it is for cash, food, child care, and other programs. Okay. This gives a little bit of overall context to the pie, which was basically in percentages. So if you look at if you think back to the four MA slides on the previous, or the four MA pieces of the pie on the previous slide, that 89% of total forecasted expenditures amounts to about $10.9 billion. An average monthly enrollment is a little over 1 million people. In Minnesota Care, that 4% piece of the pie is about $480 million in expenditures. An average monthly enrollment is about 115,000. So this slide breaks the MA totals from the last slide into the three basic eligibility categories that we deal with, and those are elderly and disabled, families with children, and adults without children. So we'll start with the elderly and disabled, which is the light blue slices of the pie. And for elderly and disabled, we spent about $6.3 billion on that group, and that includes the long-term care facilities and waiver costs, as well as the basic care. About two-thirds of the $6.3 billion, or about $4.2 billion, for this group comprises the long-term care facilities and waiver services costs. So the $6.3 billion is about 58% of total MA expenditures. And if you look on the monthly enrollees, that serves about 180,000 individuals in an average month, which is about 17% of the enrollment. So about 58% of the expenditures goes on behalf of about 17% of the enrollment. The two groups that are most impacted by the ACA are the other two groups, the families with kids and the adults without kids. That's the green and the dark blue. Combined enrollment for these groups is about 900,000 in a given month. And this enrollment has grown by about 300,000 since January of 2014 when the ACA was implemented. So there's been quite a large increase in this enrollment over the past couple of years. Again, if we go to the adults without children, the dark blue slide, piece of the pie for total expenditures, again, that's $1.6 billion in expenditures for this group, and virtually all of that in fiscal year 16 was federally funded. Okay, so now we're going to get into the projections. And so the enrollment pie from the previous slide is the first bar to the left here, the actual fiscal year 16 bar. And so this gives you an idea of what happens to that enrollment split as you move forward through the budget buy-in in fiscal year 19. So the top part of the bar, the light blue, the elderly and disabled, is growing pretty steadily at about 1.4% per year on average. However, underlying this is a bit of a different trend. Elderly is actually increasing faster than that average, while disabled individuals are growing slower than that average. And so what we're seeing on the elderly side is the first sort of evidence of the aging baby boomers, aging into the elderly category. And both of these groups have historically been fairly easy to project in terms of enrollment. Their enrollment growth sort of varies from month to month, but the sort of the long-term trend was pretty consistent. And beginning in calendar year 16, we started to see elderly enrollment rise fairly significantly above that long-term trend, and it's growing at about 3% in the forecast through fiscal year 19 as a result of that. On the other hand, disabled, beginning in 2014 with the implementation of the ACA, the disabled population actually started to come in well below projections and in some cases has fallen outright. And that is due to the fact that prior to the ACA and prior to the basis of eligibility, MA adults without children, in order for an adult without children to access MA services, they needed to get a disability determination and use the MA disabled door for eligibility. Once the MA adults without children door was available to them, as long as they don't need long-term care, home and community-based waiver services, they can access the Adults Without Children door without getting a disability determination. And what we believe is happening is that some of these people who would have come in as MA disabled now can simply come in as MA adults without kids without having to go through the disability determination. So it's a diversion away from MA disabled to MA adults without kids. And based on some sort of back-of-the-envelope estimates, we're estimating that diversion impact is upwards of around 20,000 individuals. In other words, there are 20,000 MA adults without children individuals who, without that basis of eligibility, would likely get the disability determination and go through the disabled door like they would have prior to the ACA. Okay, the very bottom bar, the dark blue one, is the MA adults without children. And you can see that enrollment falls from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 17. That is due, to the 2016 renewals process, in which about 30,000 individuals did not renew for 2016 coverage. You can see that the growth slows in 18 and 19 and actually turns negative in 19. That is the impact of the periodic data matching policy, which is expected to reduce enrollment by about 15,000 in fiscal year 19. The green, families with children enrollment, they too were impacted by the 2016 renewals process. And in that case, about 28,000 families with kids enrollees failed to renew for the 2016 coverage. And they are also impacted by the periodic data matching, and that is expected to reduce families with children enrollment by about 20,000 in fiscal year 19.
Mr. Walsh?
Mm-hmm.
Could I interrupt you for a minute? Representative Legal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to get a little clarification. Going back to the elderly and disabled part, most people probably think of MA as being health care, health care services going to the doctor. And, of course, you talked about that a bit, but in this elderly and disabled, the elderly who are in here, I assume that most of them also have Medicare, and that the ones that are, this, of course, is in no way all the health care that's going to elderly people, because a lot of people will have Medicare. But am I right in thinking that the people that would be in this elderly group on MA would be either people who are poor enough to be what we call dual eligible, so that they're getting help with their filling in the gaps of their Medicare, or it's long-term care costs for people who have spent down their assets and can't afford to be in the nursing home or something, or get home care? Is that kind of accurate?
Mr. Welsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's accurate. This enrollment here includes those that are receiving basic care only, and those that are receiving basic care with long-term care services. And almost all of the elderly that we have in Medicaid are dual eligible, but they're also Medicare eligible. And in that case, MA acts as a wraparound in Medicare coverage.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, this slide deals with projected expenditures for basic care for families with children enrollees. And this bounces around a bit, and a big piece of this story is the managed care shift that occurred from from fiscal year 15 to fiscal year 16, and from fiscal year 17 to fiscal year 18. It's a shift of May capitation payments to July, which effectively shifts the cost from one biennium to the next. And the value of that shift in the families with children is about $170 million. So what you're seeing here in the bar is that in the even years, so fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 18, you have artificially increased expenditures by about $170 million. And in the even years, in this case fiscal year 17, you have artificially low expenditures by about $170 million. And there's no shift in current law for fiscal year 19, so fiscal year 19 is unaffected by that shift. If you take that shift out and sort of rearrange the bars, and you look at average growth, the expenditures for basic care for families with kids are expected to grow about 5% per year on average from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 19. The next slide is basic care expenditures for adults without kids, and you can see that this one is heavily weighted toward federal expenditures, the blue piece. Since this population is virtually all federally funded, that managed care delay that I talked about in the last slide is not impacted here. In this case, the state funds start out small in fiscal year 16, and they grow to about $118 million in fiscal year 19. And that's because the federal funding for this group declines. The percent federal funding declines over time. And to be specific, from calendar year 14 through calendar year 16, this group was 100% federally funded. In calendar year 17, that drops to 95% federally funded. In calendar year 18, it drops to 94% federal funding. In calendar year 19, it drops to 93% federal funding. And in calendar year 20 and beyond, it's fixed at 90% federal funding. And so that's why you see the green rising over time. In this group, average annual growth is about 2% per year from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 19. This slide is basic care expenditures for the elderly and the disabled. The managed care shift, the May to July shift to capitation payments impacts this slide too, so you see a little bit of bouncing around. Without this shift, or the value of that shift for this group is about $100 million. Without the shift, these expenditures are expected to grow about 8% per year on average from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 19. Part of the reason why this percentage growth is a little bit higher than what you saw on families with kids is because the higher elderly enrollment that we talked about a couple slides ago, those new elderly enrollees are community elderly instead of institutional elderly. And community elderly are a little bit more expensive than institutional elderly because they also receive PCA services and nursing facility risk add-on in their capitation payments. And so their cap payments being higher changes the case mix, which tends to increase the expenditure trend over time. This next slide is long-term care facilities and waivers, and I'll turn it over to Susan for this one.
These expenditures include payments to facilities, primarily nursing homes, but also intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities. This also includes payments for home and community-based services, primarily waivers. Waivers are arrangements under federal Medicaid law, which allow federal funding for certain services which help people who are elderly or have disabilities stay in their homes or community-based settings as an alternative to placement in nursing homes or intermediate care facilities or acute care hospitals. The expenditures in this budget activity are almost entirely for elderly and people with disabilities. Facility expenditures are about 25% of these expenditures. It's mostly on the home and community-based side. As you can see from the chart, we spent $4.2 billion in fiscal year 16, and we expect that to grow to $5.3 billion by fiscal year 19, roughly 50% federal, 50% state. There's a small county share for some facility placements. The annualized growth rate of those expenditures comes out to about 8% per year. It's mostly coming from recipient growth. Average payment growth is less than 3% per year. Recipient growth is coming, again, on the home and community-based setting side, people using waivers more and personal care assistance more.
Okay, so that takes care of MA, and now we have a couple slides on Minnesota Care, and this one deals with Minnesota Care enrollment. The drop in enrollment from fiscal year 16 to projected fiscal year 17 is due to two things. The first is another impact here on 2016 renewals. And there were, I don't have the number in front of me here, I believe it was about 9,000 fewer enrollees made it through for 2016 renewals in Minnesota Care. And the second thing is beginning in June of 2016, premium collections were moved back to MMIS, our claims paying system. And with that, there's now stricter enforcement for non-payment of premiums. And that removed about 10,000 Minnesota Care enrollees effective June of 2016. The projected impact of the data match for Minnesota Care is about 3,500 enrollees in fiscal year 19. Average annual growth for Minnesota Care enrollment is projected to be about 1% from fiscal year 17 to fiscal year 19. And here's the last slide is Minnesota Care or BHP funding. The overall average annual growth is about 4.5% per year from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 19. You can see that Minnesota Care is funded by three sources: federal funds, which is the green, state health care access funds, which is the blue, and enrollee premiums, which is the light blue on top. In terms of premiums, the better enforcement of non-payment of premiums results in higher average revenue per enrollee, And beginning in fiscal year 17, we're projecting that average premium payment per enrollee to rise from $29 per month to $39 per month. And that's the reason for the increase in the premium collections from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 17. The other big thing that you can see here is that the dark blue, the healthcare access funds, shrinks to close to nothing beginning in fiscal year 17. And that has to do with 2017 market rates in MNsure. The second low-cost silver plan, on average in the state of Minnesota beginning in fiscal year 17, is up 60%. And so what that means for MinnesotaCare is that's a big increase in federal BHP funding, since the BHP funding is essentially the tax credits that these enrollees would have if they were on the individual market. And so higher market premiums mean bigger tax credits means more BHP funding. And in fact, it's to the point now where beginning in fiscal year 17, for a BHP eligible enrollee, their entire medical expenditures are funded by their enrollee premiums and federal BHP funding. There is no more healthcare access fund money in the payments for a BHP eligible enrollee. The only healthcare access fund money left in MinnesotaCare are for a group of elderly enrollees who are state-only funded. And these elderly enrollees, they have not had enough work quarters to qualify for free Part A Medicare, but they have too much current income to qualify for Medicaid to buy into the Part A Medicare. And so they're kind of stuck in no man's land. There's no tax credits. There's no Medicaid. And so MinnesotaCare in current law covers them with state-only money. And so the roughly $10 million in state money that you see beginning in fiscal year 17 are for that group only. Everybody else is federally funded. So that's all the prepared comments that we have. So we're available for questions.
Thank you. A couple of questions. First of all, how does the average amount Minnesota spends on MA per person on the program compare to other states?
Mr. Chair, we don't have data on the other states. That's not anything that we track in reports and forecasts. But I can tell you that for all of MA, if you look at the entirety, all funds, the average cost is about $842 per month.
Okay. And one other. How much does a 10% state share cost per year for the people who were added when MA expanded from 100% to 138% of the poverty level? Do you know that or have that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So in fiscal year 21, which is the first full state fiscal year of 90% federal funding for that group, we are projecting to spend $197.5 million on that group.
Thank you.
In state share.
Other member questions? Representative Lublin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, you know, it's now that we're kind of a ways in with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, the group that was the expansion population, I think that was what the chair was just asking about. But if we were to lose the Affordable Care Act, where would we see the big cuts coming in the charts that you've showed us? Would that be, I assume that's a lot of that is in the adults without children. I think that's a large part of the expansion population, if I'm not mistaken. Could you be kind of explicit about that? Where in these graphs would we be seeing the cuts?
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in the medical assistance slide, the eligibility group that's most impacted by the ACA and whose funding is essentially tied to the ACA is the MA Adults Without Children eligibility category, and that's the dark blue. And we spent in fiscal year 16 about $1.6 billion in total funds on that group, all of which is federal. The other piece of federal financing that's explicitly tied to the ACA is for Minnesota Care. And so that would be on the Minnesota Care slide, and it would be the last one that we looked at, and it would be the green. That's the federal BHP funding. So for fiscal year 16, that the value of that green is about $335 million.
Representative Lugar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so when the chair just asked about the cost of the expansion population in state dollars, and you said $197.5 million, and that was, I think, for fiscal year 21 projection for when we get to the most state share that group would require kind of ongoing into the future, as I understand it. That's 10%, so the federal dollars that we would be paying in 21 $197.5 million for that population. How much would we be getting in federal funds coming into our economy for that same group?
Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the federal share in fiscal year 21 is about $1.77 billion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, if I may. So for putting out an expenditure of under $200 million in state money, which admittedly that's real money, $200 million, but we're getting from the federal government $1.77 billion back for that match. And, you know, it is hard to raise state tax dollars, there's no question about it, but and there's no question, too, that these are all taxpayer dollars, and we don't want to forget that, but that's a pretty good deal for us as a state, I would say. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Welch. Just looking at the budget from DHS, I'm particularly interested in the use of the health care access funds. Looks like $358 million per year in 18 and 19, $573 in 20 and 21, that will be spent out of the health care access fund. I'm wondering what areas of the general fund those healthcare dollars are going to finance. What is that money going to be spent on outside of the healthcare area?
Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to defer the governor's budget question to Ms. Kutza.
Morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alex Kutz. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, could you repeat your question? I apologize.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kutz, the question goes to the use of the Health Care Access Fund and the spending of those dollars down from the Health Care Access Fund. It looks like $358 in 18, 19, $573 in 20 and 21. I'm wondering what non-healthcare items those are spending within the general, they're going back to the general fund. What is that money going to be used for the people who spend money within healthcare, whether you go to the dentist or the doctor, that money is the sick tax that's supposed to go for that. What are we paying for in the budget?
Ms. Cousin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, We'll have to get back to you on the specifics on that. It crosses the governor's budget beyond the human services pieces of that. We do have the decrease or the use of the healthcare access fund money in here. We also have rate increases in MA. That's part of that funding in the governor's budget. So I would have to get back to you on the specifics.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll look forward to that, to see that, because you know, the healthcare access fund was set up with its 2% sick tax to pay for Minnesota Care. The federal government stepped in, so we said, "Hey, we don't have to do that anymore. Let's step aside and let the federal government come in and do that." But here now we see that not only are we draining the healthcare access fund to spend the money elsewhere, we're depending
on the federal government, despite what Representative Liebling is warning us about. Not only are we going to get all of the money from the federal government and then some, and then, to boot, we're going to extend the sick tax on top of that. So we're raising the sick tax and kicking that out and booking $1 billion. We're spending the money out of the health care access fund, and we're anticipating that we're getting every dollar from the federal government. So I think that when you look at the extension of the sick tax, what I want to kind of know is that if we're already spending down all of the resources from the sick tax and the health care access fund, do we have any prospectively, are you willing to tell Minnesotans, particularly those hospitals, doctors, dentists, what that money is going to be going for in the future?
Ms. Cuthbert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would have to defer to other people in my organization, and we'll get back to you. We don't have the right people in the room today.
All right. For Mr. Welch, obviously there's a great number of unknowns for what's going to happen federally, but also one of the questions is, should Minnesota wait and figure out what Washington, D.C. is going to do to us, or should we start to come up with some ideas on how we should lead instead of follow? One of those things that we could do is a 1332 waiver for Innovation Health. Has there been anything that would say that we should anticipate getting some waivers and help for how we're going to plan out how much money we're going to spend and what we're going to do in the future, and have we thought about that with forecasting?
Mr. Ross.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have not been in any conversations with anybody within the department about any specifics regarding the 1332 waiver. I think everybody to this point is in a wait-and-see mode.
Representative Dean.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Walsh, obviously I understand the governor's got to put out his budget before Washington, D.C. figures out what they're going to do, and that's you have to make certain assumptions. We're not going to likely have all of the answers that we want before we put our budget together, and we have to make some reasonable assumptions about that going forward. One of the things that I think we should do is look at trying to gather all of the dollars that we currently waste. And one of the things that we're looking at is with the completion of the legislative auditor's work in the last biennium within that health and human services area and in within our public programs, eligibility determination is a big deal to figure out if we're paying for people on programs that either the people no longer live here, they no longer qualify, and those things. And I see that we book money for periodic data match into the future, but we're not doing that currently. We're not booking any money. Can you tell me why that is if we have legislatively directed the agency to do so in the last biennium?
Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding of the delay in the periodic data matching is around how county caseworkers view federal tax data, and that we've been in negotiations with the IRS about options for how to implement that, and that's what's led to the delay.
Representative Dean.
Lastly, Mr. Chair and Mr. Walsh, one of the things that has been somewhat frustrating over the years here is that DHS in forecasting has been overly conservative in biennial projections, so that we have come back and found that we are off pretty significantly in our forecasting. And when you're looking at Medicaid or Minnesota Care, if you're off by a little, it can be a lot. So when we're off by 1 or 2%, that can be an entire budget for a certain portion of HHS or another budget. with looking forward to with more uncertainty, and I would say a lot more opportunities for federal flexibility, what are you doing to make sure that we are not further off so that, let's say that our projections are $700 million too heavy, and then Representative Loon can't do anything that they might want to do within education, or Representative Davids would like to provide in a tax cut, or Representative Nornes would like to be able to provide students and so on. Those are the decisions that we have to make ahead of time in budgeting, and it has been frustrating in the past where we're off by hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and I would like to think that we're getting better at that. Can you give me some assurance or some prediction of where you're going to be?
Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, for forever, reports and forecasts, the only goal of our division is to, as accurately as possible, given the information that we have, to project enrollment and payments for use in the state budget. I mean, we are a nonpartisan, small unit of four PhD economists and seven data support people who do nothing but report to the federal government and try to get the forecast right. And so we are doing everything in our power to get that forecast right so that you guys have as accurate information as you need to make the decisions that you're elected to make. And it's been tough with the new data system and trying to you know, sort of call through the data, which is sometimes contradictory, and I think one of the things that we've done really well was we projected that there would be a huge inflow of enrollment in response to the individual mandate and the implementation of the ACA. There were lots of states out there who we heard anecdotally didn't expand, you know, didn't add an expansion group, and therefore didn't project that there would be any more Medicaid enrollment, and were surprised to find that they had thousands of additional enrollees, and it was a big budget problem in their state. Now, we projected that we would have some hundreds of thousands of additional enrollees, and it came to fruition. As for assurances, all I can assure you is that we're doing everything that we can to get this as close as we possibly can given the data that we have. As an example, in calendar year 16, so this is based on the February 2016 forecast, which we had data up through the end of calendar year 15 for this projection, we, if you look at all of the months in calendar year 16 through December of 16, our enrollment projections for all of MA were off by about 4.5%. And that was due to the fact that we lost about 55,000 individuals in February through the 2016 renewal process that we didn't anticipate. Beyond that, we were within 1% each month if you account for that 55,000. So we accumulated to about 4.5%. Actual enrollment came in about 4.5% below projected for that calendar year. Payments for that calendar year came in below forecast by about 4%. And Representative Dean, you're correct, that 4% is about $270 million. But this is all funds, and most of that was in the Adults Without Children category, which are federally funded. If you look at the elderly and the disabled, for which the ACA did not impact that group, enrollment was within about a third of a percent from projected, and payments were about 0.95% from projected. And anytime you can be within 1% 12 months out, I think that's a pretty decent job. So all I can say going forward is that we're doing the best we can.
Thank you. Representative Lubling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things. I mean, we know we're in this situation now where, and just going back to Representative Dean's comments about the provider tax and, you know, what we're going to do with that. And, you know, it would be nice if we could repeal it or reduce it or restructure it somehow to make it more fair. I mean, I think that those of us who work in Health and Human Services and probably a lot of other members have kind of struggled with that for a long time. But we are kind of in this unique situation now where we know that Republicans in Congress and in the administration are going to cut billions of dollars out of health care coming into this state. So, you know, whatever the governor is using it for in his budget, I think that we did not, when the repeal was set, we did not anticipate that that might be very, very important stream of funding to have for health care in this state to keep from having to perhaps drop a lot of Minnesotans off of their health care and also impact the economy of the state, because we really do have a very robust health care economy here. And so it is not, I think, overstating it to say that if we take billions of dollars out of our economy that comes in for health care, and then we, in addition, just cut off the provider tax, allow it to sunset, that we're going to be hurting a lot of our hospitals. A lot of our smaller hospitals are very concerned about what this means. A lot of our healthcare industry, which employs a whole lot of people in this state. So there's a multiplier effect here, which really should give us pause as we're waiting to see what Congress is going to do. After 6 years of bashing the ACA and voting to repeal it, I think over 60 times, apparently they didn't know what to do, really. They didn't really know what they wanted. And now that they have control of Congress and the presidency, who knows what is going to happen? Certainly we don't. And we're just waiting kind of at their mercy to see what Minnesotans are going to be hit with when something happens. So I just think it would be the height of foolishness right now for us to cut off a stream of funding that would be available for us to use for health care. Although I certainly think that we should look at restructuring it, making it more fair, perhaps broadening the base of it so that it can be, you know, it certainly is not a problem-free source of funding. But that's my comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you to the presenters. Next, we have Representative Anderson up with her bill. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 778 be referred to the General Register.
So move.
Mr. Chair, members, in your packet, you do have an amendment that I'd like to offer at this time, if that's all right. A-17 amendment.
Proceed.
Members, MMB and their fiscal note has expressed some concerns about how the language is currently drafted. This language addresses some of those concerns to meet the issue on tax liability and so forth, and I'd like to move that at this time.
Motion to adopt the A-17. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The bill is amended as, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that you're all very familiar with this issue. What this piece of legislation does is address the Minnesota Sports Facility Authority concerns that we've had over the probably 2 years with the structure of this, and changes the structure to have legislative input into it on a greater level, as well as directing the distribution of the stadium suites that have been part of this process as well. Those are kind of the two highlights of it. If members want to get into greater detail, I'm happy to do that. But that's it in a nutshell, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, thank you for working on this. I share a lot of your concern about about this, that I do think that it needs some additional oversight and some additional tightening up on what goes on there. My question, well, I have a few questions, but one is about the portion, I'm trying to find it here, where you are giving the Vikings, giving the suites or selling the suites back to the Vikings, I think it would be. Let's see, where is that here?
Section 9.
Thank you. Anyway, my question really is, if we're looking for a way to make sure that the public gets maximum value from these suites that right now are there for the use of the Stadium Authority, and I think I share that goal with you. And so the question would be, why give the Vikings some kind of special ability to have access to this resource that right now belongs to the public, essentially? Why not have the suites available to the highest bidder for various events? You know, I know there's a, let's see, I'm not finding it right now, but, I think there was a reference to market value here. But really, market value is something that is determined by who's willing to buy. And so I'm wondering whether you would consider or whether you have considered something like that, rather than kind of giving the Vikings some sort of favorite status. Surely there are businesses or other kinds of groups that might want to come in and bid on having a suite for a game or for the season or something like that, and even when the other kinds of activities are taking place. My concern is that the public get maximum value out of those suites, and there could be a license for that, and it could be a license that reserves some ability for the Stadium Authority to use a few seats if need be. Could you just talk a little bit about how you came to the method you've got in here for dealing with that?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, I'm going to direct you to page 5, lines 12 and 13. And on there it says the stadium suites could be returned to either the primary tenant or other interested parties in return for fair market value. And we had it drafted because I did not assume that it would go to the Vikings. We wanted to make sure that we get the best bang for our dollar, and so it could be, like you said, any of the entities that you had mentioned, because we want to maximize the payback return for this, because that benefits all taxpayers in the state of Minnesota. So it was drafted to address the very concerns that you expressed.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson. That is helpful. I guess it's the wording of a return of all stadium suites, which I don't know if maybe that needs to be tweaked a bit, because I don't know if I would consider it a return. I would think of it more as perhaps a leasing of the suites. But I think we're kind of on the same page in terms of what we are really looking for to happen. If I could, Mr. Chair,
yes.
I have another question for Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, why can we not directly use the revenue that we might get from this portion that we just discussed? Why can that revenue not go directly to help pay off the bonds that have been used to pay for the stadium in the first place, so the public's share, if you will?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. If you look in the fiscal note on page, starts on page 3 and on page 4, MMB has expressed some concerns about the federal tax regulations on the bonds that were issued. And so that's why I did the amendment to address some of those concerns and trying to work through that. And Mr. McCormick, if he's here, if he wants to, we can talk about that in greater detail. But MMB has identified this. The amendment is meant to address those concerns that they have set forth.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, could you just give a real brief explanation, or maybe Mr. McCormick needs to, of how it's structured now with the amendment, where the funds will go, and how that will work?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as the amendment says, it transfers the funds to MNB and creates a special revenue account and then allows the funds to go back to the MSFA if approved by the Commissioner of MNB for public purposes.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, maybe we should take this offline. Thank you, Representative Anderson. I'm still kind of not understanding why it can't go back to pay off the public share. That would be my concern, but I will talk with you about that offline. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the bill, Representative Anderson. I plan on supporting it. I just had a quick question on lines 2.7 and 2.8. Related to the representation from the city of Minneapolis. I didn't support public financing for this stadium to begin with, but, you know, it's in our city, and, we have a lot of issues around, a variety of issues as the host city for this. So why reducing our representation from 2 to 1 member?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein. Overall, there's been concern about the size of the commission itself, and I recognized that early on that they didn't want it to be overly cumbersome. And so to be able to limit the size and keep it somewhat close to the original board makeup, the original board is 5 members. We increased it to 7, and rather than going to 8, we'd be at an even number, and that creates problems as well.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. I understand that, but, you know, in looking at the other, I know you have these various appointees, et cetera, but, you know, I hope that moving forward we could look, if it's a 7-member board, to at least have some additional representation from Minneapolis would help, because, again, our special status as the host city, I think, is helpful to us to be able to have that kind of representation.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up a bit on Representative Liebling's line of questioning. I, too, support the bill. I think what we want to be assured of is now these suites mean there is more revenue available, and we want to see, are we assured it's going to the public and not further to enrich the Vikings? And so as I look at the amendment, so I understand MNB thought it can't go into the general fund. It's that tax issue. But if it goes into the stadium reserve excess account, maybe I misunderstand, but is that account going to be used for operating and maintenance of the building? And does that take some pressure off the Vikings, who would otherwise have to operate and maintain the structure? That's the confusion I have.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hausman. I share some of your concerns. I want to go back to paying off the debt in a faster way, but this does not benefit the Vikings as you've laid out, because actually MSFA is responsible for the maintenance and upkeep of the facility, not the Vikings.
Any other questions? Seeing none. There's no further discussion. Representative Anderson renews her motion to refer HF 778 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. And the bill is on the way to the General Register. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, before you adjourn, Mr. Chairman, we all are aware that the forecast comes out tomorrow. And I know the chair isn't here, but perhaps you as the vice chair or maybe staff knows what the timeline is going to be for the budget resolution. The rule provides for up to 25 days, but that doesn't mean that with the up to that it necessarily is going to be 25 days. So is there any enlightenment you can give us on what your timeline might be?
Maybe if Mr. Stone wouldn't mind enlightening, probably and unenlightened.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, always happy to speak into the microphone here. No, I can't add anything to that. I think a lot of it depends, well, I shouldn't speak for the chair who's sick today, but I think a lot of it depends on what happens tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, I think as a representative of the minority caucus, it would be helpful, as soon as you're aware of what that timeline would be, if we could be informed of what your goals are. I think you pronounced Carlson, and if I heard correctly, one of you did, yeah. And
I'm sorry.
Just as a, once in a while, I would have a student from the South when I was a teacher, and I always thought Carlson was one that was easy to pronounce, but my Southern students used to refer to me as Mr. Carson. With all due respect, they just dropped the L. I don't know if you have a Southern background or not, but I'll stop there, Mr.
Well, Representative Carlson, I am from Elko New Market, which is south of here, so
that might probably,
kind of a transition here.
Yeah, thank you.
With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.